You're tuned in to CICK 93.9 FM Smithers Community Radio. This is River Reads with host and narrator River Wild. A story hour where those of all ages can escape into bedtime stories and fairy tales, new and old, but mostly old and at times macabre, or silly, or even perhaps a little confusing, as written in Old English, and the host sometimes fumbles the odd word, and then there's those stories whose premise or message has aged poorly. But let's face it, you can't be picky when you're dependent upon copyright-free material available through Creative Commons. So, if you enjoy a narrated story and don't mind a weird tale, let's begin.
River Reads has been recognized as the recipient of a national award, the Broadcast Dialogues Canadian Radio Awards, winning Best Podcast in the Small Market category.
River Reads is not a kids' show, but is not a kids' show. Listener's discretion is advised.
This week on River Reads, episode 25, Creatures of Small, we'll be featuring stories from collection Fairy Tales and Stories by Hans Christian Andersen, including The Beetle and Elfin Hill, plus reading The Blue Light from the collection Grimm's Fairy Tales by Brothers Grimm.
Gender Blender.
Stay tuned till the end for this episode's Gender Blender tale is revealed. The suspense. And now for...
River Rambles.
Hello. I am your host, River Wild, recording live from under my stairs, aka not really live. I, of course, just record this way to cut down on my editing. Plus, as always, back in my living room, once again on the comfy couch. So episode 25, Creatures of Small. And as a small creature myself, I can attest to the fabulousness of such small sizes. Today's tale involves a bunch of small things, from beetles to little men, though all I must say have some pretty big personalities, not unlike myself, maybe. One might say a bit of an ego. Anyways, nothing wrong with that. Confidence. It's when confidence bleeds onto others and separates you from others. Does it become a problem? As our heroes in these tales, definitely it could use a lesson in humble pie. Now I want pie. And really, I didn't make many more notes after that. It's been a while since I've been doing anything on here, and now that I'm here, wow, it's been forever. And I think I didn't leave too much time for me to ramble, but more than we ever possibly could need. I don't think I can talk slow the whole way through it. And I tried to make a song, but then I was just like, no, I don't want to do a song. So here I am. It's been such a full few months for me. I have been engaging with a lot of my community work and making some great new friendships and connections, and I just have so appreciated and been so humbled by all the generosity and warmth that I've been able to experience when I've been able to kind of make these new friends. So it's been wonderful. And I don't know what else. I read these stories so long ago, I don't know much about them, so I can't even really talk about them. And at this point, you're probably going like, why didn't you just do a song? You could have just done a song. I have written my own song, but it's not ready for this at all. And it's like a lyrical one, actually has lyrics and stuff. But yeah, I think I have really run out of time. So I think we might just need to squeeze in a song. Or just by luck, time is there and we're good and we're peasy. All I know is I've been enjoying my break and it's nice to be back, but definitely I am rusty. Rusty. Let's get going. I think we're ready to start. I think we made it. The Elfin Hill, from the collection of Fairy Tales by Hans Andersen. And a heads up, there are over 17 different characters. I'm going to do my best to keep track of all the voices. We might get a little lost, so hang on. Here we go. The Elfin Hill. Some large lizards were running nimbly about in the clefts of an old tree. They could understand each other very well, for they spoke lizard language. "How is it rambling and buzzing in the old elfin tree?" said one lizard. "I've not been able to close my eyes for 2 nights because of the noise. I might just as well lie and have a toothache, for then I can't sleep either."
"There's something going on in there," said another lizard.
"They let that hill stand on 4 red posts till cock crow, to have it regularly aired, and that elfin girls have learnt new dances, with some stamping in them. There's something going on."
"Yes, I have talked with an earthworm of my acquaintance," said the third lizard. "The earthworm came straight out of the hill, where he was grubbing in the ground night and day. He had heard a great deal. He can't see, poor creature, but he understands how to wriggle about and listen. They expect visitors in the Elfin Hill, visitors of rank, but who they are the earthworm could not tell, and perhaps indeed he did not know. All the will-o'-the-wisps are ordered to hold a torch dance, as it is called, and the silver and gold, of which there is plenty in the Elfin Hill, is being polished and put out in the moonshine."
"Who may these strangers be?" asked all the lizards. "What can be going on? Hark how it hums and how it rumbles."
At the same moment, the Elfin Hill opened, and an old elfin maiden, hollow at the back, for the rest a very respectable dressed, came tripping out. She was the old elfin king's housekeeper. She was a distant relative of the family, and wore an amber heart on her forehead. Her legs moved so rapidly, trip, trap, trip. Gracious, how she could trip! Straight down to the moor to the night raven.
"You are invited to the Elfin Hill this evening," said she. "But will you do me a great service and undertake the invitations? You ought to do something, as you don't keep house yourself. We shall have some very distinguished friends, troll folk, who have something to say. And so the old elfin king wants to make a display."
"Who has been invited?" asked the night raven.
"To the grand ball all the world may come, even human beings, if they can talk in their sleep or can do something in our way. But for the banquet, the company is to be strictly select. I shall only have the most distinguished. I have a dispute with the Elfin King, for in my opinion, we could not even admit ghosts. The merman and his daughters must be invited first. They may not be pleased, much pleased, but to come dry land. But they shall have a wet stone to sit upon, or something still better. And then I think they won't refuse for this once. All the old trolls of the first class, with tails, and the wood demon with his gnomes, we must have. And then I think we may not leave out the grave pig, the dead horse, and the church dwarf, though they certainly belong to the clergy, who are not of our class. But that's only their vocation. They are close related to us, and frequently pay us visits."
"Caw!"
said the night raven, and flew off at once to give the invitations. The elfin girls were already dancing on the Elfin Hill, and they danced with long shawls woven of mist and moonshine that looked very pretty for those who like that sort of thing. In the middle of the Elfin Hill was the great hill, splendidly decorated. The floor had been washed with moonshine, and the walls rubbed with witches' fat, so that they shone in the light like tulips. In the kitchen, plenty of frogs were roasting on the spit, snail skins with little children's fingers, and salads of mushroom spawn wet mice notes, and hemlock, bear brewed by the marsh witch, sparkling salt prayer wine from grave cellars, all very substantial eating. Rusty nails and church window glass were among the sweets. The old elfin king had his golden crown polished with powdered slate pencil. It was slate pencil from the first form, and it's very difficult for the elfin king to get first form slate pencil. In the bedroom, curtains were hung up and fastened with snail slime. Yes, there was indeed a rumbling and jostling there.
"Now we must perform the place by burning horsehair and pig's bristle, and then I think I shall have done my part," said the old elfin maiden.
"Father dear," said the youngest daughter, "may I hear now who our distinguished guests are to be?"
"Well," said he, "I suppose I must tell you now. Two of my daughters must be prepared to be married. Two will certainly be married. The old goblin from Norway. He lives in the old Dovrish field and possesses many strong castles on the rocky hills. And a gold mine, which is better than anyone, I think, is coming with his two sons, who both want to choose a wife. The old goblin is a true old Norwegian veteran, merry and straightforward. I knew him from my old days when we drank with one another. He came here to fetch his wife. Now she is dead. She is a daughter of the king of the Chalk Cliffs of Moen. He took his wife on tick, as saying it is. Oh, how I'm longing for the old Norwegian gnome. His sons, they say, are rather rude, forward youngsters, but perhaps people do them wrong, and they'll be right enough when they grow older. Let me see that you can teach them manners."
"Ah, and when will they come?" asked one of his daughters.
"It depends on wind and weather," said the elfin king. "They travel economically. They come when there's a chance of a ship. I wanted them to go across Sweden, but the old one did not like that way. He does not advance with the times. I don't like that."
Just then, too, Will o' the Wisp came hopping up, one quicker than the other, and so one came first.
"They're coming! They're coming!" they cried.
"Give me my crown, and let me stand in the moonshine," said the elfin king,
and the daughters lifted up their shawls and bowed down to the ground. There stood the old goblin from Djor, with a crown of hardened icicles and polished fir cones. Moreover, he wore a bearskin and a great warm boots. His sons, on the contrary, went bare-necked, and with no braces, for they were strong men.
"Is that a hill?"
asked the youngest of the boys, and he pointed to the elfin hill.
"Up in Norway, we should call it a hole."
"Boys," said the old man, "a hole goes in, a hill goes up. Have you no eyes in your heads?"
The only thing they wondered at down there, they said, was they could understand the language without difficulty.
"Don't give yourself airs," said the old man. "One would think you are not full-fledged."
And then they went into the elfin hill, where the really grand company was assembled, and that is such haste that one might almost say they had been blown together. But for each it was nicely and prettily arranged. The sea folk sat at a table in a big wash-tubs. They said it was just as they were at home. All showed good table manners except the two northern trolls, and they put their legs up on the table. But they thought that everything became them.
"Feet off the table," said the old goblin,
and they obeyed, but not immediately. The ladies who sat next to them then tickled pine cones that they had brought with them, and then took off their boots to be more at their ease, and gave them to the ladies to hold. But their fathers, the old Davin goblin, was quite different. He told such fine stories of imposing Norwegian rocks, and of the waterfalls which rushed down white with foam, with a noise like thunder and the sound of organs.
He told of the salmon that leaped up the rushing streams when the Nixies played upon her golden harp. He told of shining winter nights when the sled bells are jingling and the lads skate with burning torches over the clear ice, which so transparent that they can see the fishes start beneath their feet. Yes, you could tell it so finely that they saw and heard what he described. It was just as if the sawmills were going, as if the servants and maids were singing songs and dancing the hauling dance. Hurrah! All at once the old goblin gave the old elfin girl a smacking kiss. That was a kiss. And yet they were not related to each other at all. Then the elfin maidens had to dance, first in the usual way, then with stamping steps that suited them well. Then came the artistic and solo dance. Gracious! How they could stretch their legs! Nobody knew where they began and where they ended, which were their arms and which were their legs. They were all mixed up like wood shavings. And then they whirled around till the deaf horse turned giddy and was obliged to leave the table.
Brr, said the old goblin. That's good fun for the legs. But what else can they do besides dancing, stretching their legs, and making a whirlwind? That you shall soon know, said the elfin king.
And he called out the youngest of his daughters. She was as dainty and light as moonshine. She was the most delicate of all the sisters. She took a white shaving in her mouth and disappeared. That was her gift.
But the old goblin said that he should not like his wife to possess this gift. And he did not think that his boys would either.
The second could walk beside her own self, just as if she had a shadow. And that is what the troll folk never have. The third daughter was of quite another kind. She had learned in the brewhouse of the marsh witch, and understood how to lard elder tree logs into glowworms.
She still make a good housewife, said the old goblin, and then he winked a health to her with his eyes, for he did not want to drink too much.
Next came the fourth elfin girl. She had a big golden harp to play upon, and when she struck the first string, all lifted up their left feet, for the trolls are left-legged. And when she struck the second chord, all had to do what she wished.
That's a dangerous woman, said the old elfin.
But both his sons went out of the hill, for they had had enough of it.
And what can the next daughters do?
Asked the old goblin. I have learned to love everything that is Norwegian, she said. And I will never marry unless I go to Norway. But the youngest sister whispered to the old king, that's not only because she's heard in a Norwegian song that when the world sinks, down the cliffs of Norway will remain standing like monuments, and so she wants to get there, because she is afraid of sinking down too.
Ho, ho, said the old goblin. Is that the meaning of it? But what can the seventh and last do? The sixth come before the seventh, said the elfin king, for he could count.
But the six would not come out.
I can only tell people the truth, she said. Nobody cares for me, and I have enough to do to sew my shroud.
Now came the seventh and last. And what could she do? Why, she could tell stories, as many as ever she wished.
Here are all my five fingers, said the old goblin. Tell me one for each.
And she took him by the wrist, and he laughed till he chuckled. And when she came to the ring finger, which had a golden ring around its waist, just as if it knew there was to be a wedding, the old goblin said,
hold fast. What have you have? The hand is yours. I'll have you for a wife myself.
And the elfin girl said the story of the Ringfinger, and of the little Peter Playman, the fifth, were still to be told.
"We'll hear those in winter," said the goblin, "and we'll hear about the pine tree and the birch and the fairy's present and the crackling frost. You shall tell your tales, or no one up there knows how to do that well, and then we'll sit in stone rooms where the pine logs burn and drink mead out of the golden horns of the old Norwegian kings. And Necken has given me a couple. And when we sit there and the Nixies come on a visit, she'll sing you all the songs of the Satyr girls. They will be merry. The salmon will leap into the waterfall against the stone walls. But they cannot come in."
"Yes, it's very good living in the dear old Norway, but where are my boys?"
Yes, where were the boys? They were running in the fields and blowing out the will-o'-the-wisps, which had come so kindly for the torch dance.
"What's all this romping about?" said the old goblin. "I've taken a mother for you, and now you may take one of the aunts."
But the lads said that they would rather make a speech and drink good fellowship. They did not want to marry. They made speeches and drank brotherhood, and tipped up their glasses on their nails to show they had emptied them. Afterwards, they took their coats off, lay down on the table to sleep, for they did not stand on ceremony. But the old goblin danced about the room with his young bride, and he changed boots with her, for that's more fashionable than exchanging rings.
"The cock is a-crowing,"
said the old elfin girl who kept house.
"Now we must shut the shutters, so that the sun may not burn us."
And the hill shut itself up. But outside the lizards ran up and down in the cleft tree, and one said to the other,
"Oh, how much I like the old Norwegian goblin!"
"I like the boys better," said the earthworm. But he could not see the miserable creature.
The Beetle. Fairy Tales by Hans Andersen. The Empress's favorite horse was sawed with gold. She had a golden horseshoe on each foot. But why was that? She was a beautiful creature, with slender legs, bright, intelligent eyes and a mane that hung down like a veil over her neck. She had carried her master through the smoke of gunpowder and the rain of bullets, and had heard the balls whistling past. She had bitten, kicked, and taken part in the fight when the enemy pressed forward, and leaping with the Empress across the fallen horse of one of the foe, had saved the bright golden crown and the life of the Empress. And that was worth more than all the bright gold. And that is why the Empress's horse had golden horseshoes. A beetle came creeping out.
"First the great, then the small," said she. "But size is not everything."
And with that, she stretched out her thin legs.
"Well, what do you want?" asked the smith.
"Golden shoes,"
cried the beetle.
"Why, you must be out of your senses," cried the smith. "You want golden shoes, too?"
"Certainly, golden shoes," said the beetle. Am I not as good as the creature there, that is waited on, brushed, and has food and drink before here? Don't I belong to the Emperor's stable, too?"
"But why has the horse golden shoes?" asked the smith. "Don't you understand that?"
"Understand? I understand that it is a personal slight for me," said the beetle. "It is done to vex me, and I will, therefore, go out into the wide world."
"Go along,"
said the smith.
"You rude fellow," said the beetle.
And then she went out the stable, flew a short distance, and soon afterwards found herself in a beautiful flower garden, fragrant with roses and lavender.
"Isn't it beautiful here?"
asked one of the birds that were flying about with their red shield-shaped black spotted wings.
"How sweet it is, and how lovely."
"I have been used to better than that," said the beetle. "You call this beautiful? Why, there's not even a dunghill."
Then she went on, under the shadow of a big gilliflower, where a caterpillar was creeping along.
"How beautiful the world is," said the caterpillar. "The sun is so warm, and everything so happy. And one day I fall asleep and die. All they call it, I shall awake as a butterfly."
"What things you do fancy," said the beetle, "to fly about as a butterfly. I come from the Emperor's stable. But no one there, not even the Empress's favorite horse, that wears my cast-off golden shoes, fancies anything like that. Get wings, fly. Well, we fly now."
And away flew the beetle.
"I don't want to be vexed, but I am all the same," she said, as she flew off.
Soon afterwards she fell upon a great lawn. Here she lay a while and pretended to be asleep, but at last she really dozed off. Suddenly, a heavy shower of rain fell from the clouds. The noise awoke the beetle, and she wanted to creep into the earth, but could not, for she was being turned over and over. First she was swimming on her stomach, then on her back, and flying was not to be thought of. She despaired of getting away from the place alive. So she lay where she lay, and remained there. When the rain had left off a little, and the beetle had blinked the water out of her eyes, she saw the gleam of something white. It was linen laid out to bleach. She reached it and crept into a fold of a damp linen. It was certainly not so comfortable here as it in the warm dunghill in the stable, but nothing better happened to be on hand, and so she stayed where she was. Stayed a whole day and a whole night, and the rain stayed too. Towards morning, she crept out. She was greatly annoyed at the climate. On the linen sat two frogs, their bright eyes sparkling with pure joy.
"This is glorious weather," said one. "How refreshing! And a linen keeps the water together so beautifully. My hind legs are itching to swim."
"I should really like to know," said the other,
whether the swallow, which flies about so far, has ever found a better climate than ours. Here, oh, there are many travels abroad. So nice and damp. Really is like lying in a wet ditch. Whoever doesn't like this can't be said to love their country.
This is CICK 93.9 FM Smithers Community Radio, and you're listening to the national award-winning show, River Reads, hosted by narrator River Wild. As a nonprofit community radio station, we rely on our silver sponsors, like Mountain Eagle Books. Thank you, Mountain Eagle Books, for your invaluable support towards promoting local music and community radio. Now, let's continue with our scheduled programming.
Have you never been in the Emperor's stable? Asked the beetle. There the dampness is warm and fragrant. That's the climate for me. But you can't take it when you travel. Is there no dung hung heap in the garden here, where people of rank, like myself, can feel at home and take up their quarters? The frogs either could not or would not understand her. I never asked twice, exclaimed the beetle, after she had already asked three times and received no answer. Thereupon she went a little further, and came upon a piece of broken pottery, which should certainly not have been lying there, but which, as it lay, afforded a good shelter against wind and weather. Here lived several families of earwigs. They did not require much, only company. They were full of tender maternal love, and every one therefore praised their child as the most beautiful and cleverest.
"Our little child is engaged to be married," said one earwig.
"Sweet innocence! It is this sole ambition to get into a parson's ear some day. Oh, her is so artless and lovable. This engagement will keep her steady. What joy for us!"
Our child," said another, "can hardly creep out of eggs. When she was off on her travels, 'tis all her life and spirit, she'll run her horns off. What joy for us! Isn't it so, Mrs. Beetle?"
They recognized the stranger by the cut of her wings. "You are both right," said the beetle. And then she begged her to enter the room. Oh, and then they begged her to enter the room. That is to say, to come as far as she could under the piece of pottery.
"Now you can see my little earwigs too,"
cried a third.
"They are the sweetest children and very playful. They are never naughty, except when they occasionally pain. And their inside, unfortunately, one gets those only too easily at their age."
In this manner, everyone spoke of their children, and the babies joined in too, and used the little nippers that they have in their tails to pull the beetle by her beard.
"Yes, they're always up to something, the little rogues," said the earwigs, bubbling over with affection.
But the bored beetle, and so she asked whether it was much further to the dunghill.
"Why, what's out in the wide world on the other side of the ditch?" answered an earwig. "I hope none of my children would go so far. It would be the death of me."
"I'll try to get as far anyhow," said the beetle, and she went off without saying goodbye, for this is considered the most polite way. But by the ditch she met several of her kind, all beetles.
"We live here," they said. "We are very comfortable. May we ask you to step down into the rich mud? The journey has no doubt been very fatiguing for you."
"Very," said the beetle. "I have been exposed to the rain and have had to lie on linen, and cleanliness always weakens me very much. I have pain, too, in one wing through having stood in draught under a broken piece of pottery. It is really quite a comfort to get once more among one's own kinded."
"Perhaps you come from the dung heap?" asked the eldest.
"Oh, from the highest place," cried the beetle. "I come from the Empress's stable, where I was born with
golden shoes on my feet. I'm traveling on a street mission, but you must not ask me any questions about it, for I won't betray the secret. With that, the beetle stepped down into the rich mud. There sat three young beetles. They giggled, because they did not know what to say.
They're all three still disengaged, said their mother, and the youngest beetle giggled again, this time more bashfulness.
I have not seen greater beauties than the emperor's stables, said the beetle, taking a rest. Don't you spoil my girls for me, and don't speak to them unless you have serious intentions. But about that I have no doubt, and so I give you my blessing.
Hurrah!
Cried all the other beetles, and our beetle was now engaged. The engagement was immediately followed by a wedding, for there was no reason for delay. The following day passed very pleasantly, and the one after the fairly so. But on the third day the time had come to think of food for the earwig, and perhaps even for the children.
I have allowed myself to be taken in, thought the beetle. Nothing is therefore left for me but to take others in return.
So said, so done. Away she went, and stayed out the whole day and the whole night. And her earwig sat there, a lonely widower.
Oh, said the other beetles. That beetle we received for our to our family is a thorough vagabond. She went away and left her earwig sitting there to be a burden upon us.
Well, then she must be passed off as unmarried again and stay here as my child, said the mother. Fie on the villain who deserted her.
In the meantime, the beetle had gone on travelling, and it sailed across the watery ditch on a cabbage leaf. In the morning, two people came to the ditch. When they spied her, they picked her up, turned her over and over, and looked very wise, especially of them. A girl.
Alas, says the black beetle in the black stone. And in the black rock, isn't it written?
Then she translated the beetle's name into Latin, and enlarged upon its species and nature. A second person, an older scholar, was for taking her home with them, but the other said that they had specimens quite as good as that, and this, our beetle thought, was not a polite thing to say. So she suddenly flew out of the speaker's hand. Her wings being now dry, she flew a pretty long distance and reached a hot bed, where one of the widows of the glass house being ajar, she slipped in comfortably and buried herself in the fresh manure.
How delightful it is in here, she said.
Soon after she fell asleep and dreamt that the empress's favorite horse had fallen and had given her her golden horseshoes with the promise to have two more made for her. That was very acceptable. When the beetle awoke, she crept out and looked about her. What splendor there was at the hothouse! In the background were palm trees growing to a great height, and the sun made them look transparent. And under them, what a wreath of verdure and bright flowers! Red as fire, yellow as amber, and white as driven snow.
There is an incomparable splendor in these plants, said the beetle. How fine they will taste when they decay! This is good larder. They must certainly be relatives of mine living here. I'll have a look around to see if I can find someone, anyone associate with. Proud I am. That is my pride.
And now she strolled about in the hothouse and thought of her beautiful dream of the dead horse and the golden horseshoes she had inherited. Suddenly a hand seized the beetle, squeezed her, and turned her over and over. The gardener's daughter and a little boy who played with her had come up to the hotbed, had spied the beetle, and wanted to have some fun with her. First she was wrapped up in a vine leaf, and then put into warm trouser pocket. Then she crippled and grabbled about with all her might, but for this she got a squeeze from the girl's hand, and that taught her to be quiet. Then the girl ran off to the great lake at the end of the garden. Here the beetle was put into an old
half-broken wooden shoe, in which a little stick was placed for a mass. And to this mass the beetle was bound by a woolen thread. Now she was a sailor and had to sail. The lake was not very large, but to the beetle it seemed like an ocean. She was so terrified by it that she fell on her back and kicked about with her feet. The little ship sailed away, and the current of the water seized it. But when it went too far from the shore, the little girl would turn up her trousers and go into the water and fetch it back to the land. But at last, just as it was setting out to sea again in full sail, the children were called away for something important. They hastened to obey, and running away from the lake, left a little ship to its fate. This drifted further and further away from the shore, and further out into the open sea. It was terrible for the beetle, for she could not get away, being bound to the mast. Then a fly paid her a visit.
"What lovely weather!" said the fly. "I'll rest here, bask in the sun. It's very pleasant for you here."
"You talk of what you don't understand. Don't you see that I'm tied fast?"
"But I'm not," said the fly, and flew off. "Well, now I know the world," said the beetle. "It's a base world. I'm the only honest one in it. First they refuse me golden shoes, then I have to lie on wet linen and stand in a draught. And to cap all, they fasten me earwig as a partner. Then when I have taken a quick step out into the world and learned how comfortable one can be there and how it ought to be for me, up comes a human girl, binds me fast and leaves me to the wild waves, while the Empress's favorite horse prances about in golden shoes. That vexes me most of all. But one must not count on sympathy in this world. My career's very interesting, but what's the use of that if nobody knows it? The world doesn't deserve to be made acquainted with my story, for it ought to have been given me golden shoes in the Empress's stable when the Empress's favorite horse was being sawed, and I stretched out my legs too. If I had received golden shoes, I should have been an ornament to the stable. Now the stable has lost me. The world has lost me. All is over." But all was not over. A boat, in which there were some young girls, came rowing up.
"Look, there's an old wooden shoe sailing along," said one of the girls. "There's a little girl creature tied up in it," cried another.
The boat came quite close to our beetle's little ship, and the young girls fished it up out of the water. One of them drew a small pair of scissors out of her pocket, cut the woolen thread without hurting the beetle, and when she got to the shore, placed her on the grass.
"Creep, creep, fly, fly, if thou canst," she said. "Freedom is a glorious thing."
The beetle flew up and went through the open window of a large building. There she sank down, tired and exhausted, upon the fine, soft, long mane of the Empress's horse that was standing in the stables where both she and the beetle were at home. The beetle clung fast to the mane, sat there quite still for a short time, and recovered.
"Here I sit on the Empress's favorite horse. Sit on her just like an empress. But what was I going to say? Oh, yes, I remember. It's a good idea and quite correct. Why does the Empress's horse have golden shoes? That's what the smith asked me. Now the answer is clear to me. The horse has golden horseshoes on my account."
And now the beetle was in good temper.
"Travelling opens up one's mind," she said.
The sun's rays came streaming into the stable upon her, and made things bright and pleasant.
"The world is not so bad after all, when you come to examine it," said the beetle. "But you must know how to take it."
Yes, the world was beautiful,
because the empress's favorite horse had only received golden shoes so that the beetle might become her rider.
Now I will go down to the other beetles and tell them how much has been done for me. I will relate to them all the disagreeable things I went through in my travels abroad, and tell them that I shall now remain at home till the horse has worn out her golden shoes.
The following is rated PGD, meaning it contains possible gore or death. It's pretty tame, but someone is killed. Sensitive viewers may want to tune back in just under 10 minutes.
The Blue Light, from Grimm's Fairy Tales. There was once a soldier who had served his king well and faithfully for many years. But on account of his many wounds, he could serve no longer. The king said,
"You go home now. I have no further need for you, and I can only pay those who serve me."
The soldier did not know what to do for a living, and he went sadly away. He walked all day till he reached a wood, and there in the distance he saw a light. On approaching it, he found a house inhabited by a witch.
"Pray give me shelter for the night and something to eat and drink," he said, "or I shall perish."
"Oh, ho!" she said. "Who gives anything to a runaway soldier, I should like to know? But I will be merciful and take you in, if you will do something for me."
"What is it?" asked the soldier.
"I want you to dig up my garden tomorrow."
The soldier agreed to do this, and the next day he worked as hard as he could, but he could not finish it before evening.
"I see," said the witch, "that you can do no more this evening. I will keep you one more, and tomorrow you shall split up some logs for firewood."
The soldier took the whole day over this task, and in the evening the witch proposed that he should again stay another night.
"You shall only have a very light task tomorrow," she said. "There is an old dry well beside my house. My light, which burns blue and never goes out, has fallen into it, and I want you to bring it back."
Next day, the witch led him to the well and let him down in a basket. He found the light and made a sign to be pulled up. But when he was near the top, the witch put out her hand and wanted to take it from him. But seeing her evil designs, he said, "No, I will not give you the light till I have both feet safe on dry land again." The witch flew into a passion, let him fall back into the well again, and went away. The poor soldier fell on the damp ground without being injured, and the blue light burnt as brightly as ever. But what was the good of that? He saw that he could not escape death. He sat for some time feeling very sad. Then, happening to put his hand into his pocket, he found his pipe still half full.
"This will be my last pleasure,"
he thought as he lighted it at the blue light and began to smoke. When the cloud of smoke he made cleared off a little, a tiny black man appeared before him and asked,
"What are your orchards?"
"What do you mean?" the soldier asked in amazement.
"I must do anything you command,"
said the little man.
"Oh, if that is so," said the soldier, "get me out of the well first."
The little man took him by the hand and led him through an underground passage. But the soldier did not forget to take the blue light with him. On the way, he showed the soldier all the treasures the witch had amassed there, and the soldier took as much gold as he could carry. When they reached the top, he said to the little man,
"Now go and bind the witch and take her before the judge."
Before long, the witch came by, riding at a furious pace on a tomcat and screaming at the top of her voice. The little man soon after appeared and said,
"Everything is done as you command, and the witch hangs on the gallows. What further orders have you?"
"Nothing at the moment," answered the soldier. "You can go home. Only be at hand when I call."
"You only have to light your pipe at the blue light, and I will be there," said the little man. And then he vanished.
The soldier went back to the town that he had left and ordered some new clothes. Then he went to the best inn and told the landlord to give him the best rooms. When he had been taken possession, he summoned the little black man and said, "I served my king faithfully, but he sent me away to die of hunger. Now I will have my revenge."
"What do you wish me to do?"
asked the little man. "Late at night, when the princess is sleeping in her bed, bring her asleep to me, and I will make her do menial services for me."
"It is easy enough thing for me to do," said the little man. "But it will be a bad business for you if it happens."
As the clock struck 12, the door sprang open, and the little man bore the maiden in.
"Aha! There you are!" cried the soldier. "Set about your work at once. Fetch the broom and sweep the floor."
When she had finished, he sat down and ordered her to take off his boots. Then he threw them at her and made her pick them up and clean them. She did everything he ordered without resistance, silently, and with half-shut eyes. At the first cock crow, the little man carried her away to the royal palace and put her back in bed. In the morning, when the princess got up, she went to her father and told him that she had had an extraordinary dream.
"I was carried through the streets of lightning speed and taken to the room of a soldier, whom I had to serve as a maid and do all kinds of menial work. I had to sweep the room and clean his boots. Of course, it was only a dream, and yet I am as tired this morning as if I had done it all."
"The dream could not have been true," said the king. "But I will give you a piece of advice. Fill your pockets with peas and cut a little hole in it. If you are carried away again, and they will drop out and leave a trail on the road."
When the king said this, the little man was standing by, invisible, and heard it all. That night, when he carried off the princess, the peas certainly fell out of her pocket, but they were useless to trace her by, for the cunning little man had scattered peas all over the streets. Again the princess had to perform her menial duties till cock crow. The next morning the king sent out people who were to find the trail, but they were unable to do so, because in every street the poor child were picking up peas and saying,
"It must have rained peas in the night."
"We must devise a better plan," said the king. "Keep your shoes on when you go to bed, and before you come away from the place where you are taken, hide one of them. I shall be sure to find it."
The little man heard this plan also, and when the soldier told him to bring the princess again, he advised him to put it off. He said he knew no further means against their craftiness, and if the shoe was found, it would be very dangerous for him.
"Do as I tell you," said the soldier.
And for the third time, the princess was brought and made to work like a servant. But before leaving, she hid one of her shoes under the bed. Next morning, the king ordered the whole town to be searched for his daughter's shoes, and it soon found it in the soldier's room. He himself, at the request of the little man, had gone outside the gates, but before long he was seized and thrown into prison. In his flight he had forgotten his greatest treasure, the blue light and his gold. He had but one ducat in his pocket. As he stood loaded with chains at his window in prison, he saw one of his comrades going by. He tapped on the pane and said,
"Be so good as to fetch me the little bundle I left behind at the inn, and I will give you a ducat."
His comrade hurried off and brought him the bundle. As soon as the soldier was alone, he lighted his pipe and summoned the little man.
"Don't be afraid," he said to his master. "Go where they take you, and let what will happen only take the blue light with you."
Next day a trial was held, and although the soldier had done no harm, the judge sentenced him to death. When he was led out to execution, he asked a last favor of the king.
"What is your wish?" asked the king.
"That I may smoke a last pipe."
"You may smoke thee," answered the king.
"But don't imagine I will therefore grant you your life."
Then the soldier drew out his pipe and lighted it at the blue light. As soon as a few rings of smoke arose, the little man appeared with a little cuddle in his hand and said,
"What is it that you command?"
"Strike the false judge and his minions to the ground, and do not spare the king either for all his cruelty to me."
Then the little man flew about like lightning, zigzag, hither and thither, and whomever he touched with his cruddle fell to the ground, and begging on his knees that his life might be spared, and dare not move. The king was now seized his daughter to the soldier to be his wife.
Gender Blender. This week's episode 25, Creatures of Small Gender Blender Tales, was The Beetle from Fairy Tales by Hans Andersen. Tune in weekly for Gender Blender Tales, reimagining classic fairy tales, challenging traditional gender roles and stereotypes, from dragon slayers to fairies. All revealed at the end of each episode. Let's do this again.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of the radio station and any entities they represent. In addition, the stories and any possible twisted messages relayed do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of the host, twisted as they are and despite what they might tell you, or the radio station, or their affiliates, or any entities they represent, and solely are those of the author, if even that, for that matter. Also, just now, I'm referring to the host being twisted, not the station being twisted, even if they happen to be so, and that's all I'm saying about that.
As a non-profit, we rely on sponsors like Smithers Brewing Company. Thank you, Smithers Brewing Company, for supporting local community radio.
This is CICK 93.9 FM Smithers Community Radio. You have been listening to River Reads, with host River Wild. For more River Reads, tune in weekly every Saturday at 10 a.m. and Sundays at 9 a.m. See you then.